Okay, I guess it's time to get rolling here. Turn to the Book of Ruth. You turn wherever you want in the book, in those four chapters. Ben sends his regrets that he's not here tonight. He had to go do something in the Bay Area for a job. So I'm just a substitute teacher. So don't disrespect me just because of that. We're going to start on Esther on Sunday. So we're going to spend the month of February on Esther. So it'll be kind of an abbreviated study. I'll have a lesson shoot out probably tomorrow or next day. So be looking for that. But that'll be a fun study, I know. What we're going to do tonight is just, if you saw the email, is just to discuss this book and what you got out of it. This could be a very quiet evening if we're not, if it doesn't go well. I notice on Wednesday night people tend to be a little less chatty than they are on Sunday. And I usually get stuck with Wednesday night, so I'm in the less chatty group. But what I put up on the so-called, it's real, not really a lesson sheet, it's just kind of a thing here, if you want to have to put notes on. They said, in our study of Ruth, reflect on what has surprised you, inspired you, taught you, or helped you in your spiritual journey. So really focusing on the, we've learned the story well, so now we're kind of focusing on how that has affected us, how this story has affected us. What did you find most interesting? How did the flow of the story affect you, both intellectually and emotionally? Did the empty, full theme resonate with you? What was your favorite part of the story? Okay, so you got that? So we can have a conversation about that, and hopefully draw some good lessons out of that. Zach, would you do some work for us? So it's time for us to do some gleaning here. Did her gleaning, so... who wants to start us off? Go ahead.
Well, what I found so interesting was all the layers and the depth of this story that I never before realized were there.
Yeah.
You know, and so many things going on with... it wasn't just the story of Naomi and her daughter-in-law, Ruth, but there were things to be gleaned about her other daughter-in-law. There were things to be gleaned about Boaz and the way things were back then, and the things that they did at the gate, which was sort of like their court, and the things that they did for as far as the Redeemer and the parallels. You know, we have a Redeemer. It's not a perfect parallel, but there's some interesting things about that.
Yeah, that's it is a multi-layered, multifaceted story that, and especially interesting since it's such a relatively short one. But also, I know that we've spent a lot of time. I'm not going to say. Well, I guess the term speculating is okay. I mean, the fact that there's some things in here that, you know, make us wonder. You know, did it go? Was it about the motives of these people and things like that? Exactly what's going on? I think that's a good discussion because it helps us to kind of realize that these are real people, just like us. During this time, and they're, you know, you have most of our lives are multi-layered, right? If you look back on them and how things develop and the choices you have and all those kinds of things, that's a good observation. It is definitely, and I think that's why. Is it Rosh Hashanah where they read this story every year? I can't remember Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur.
Can't remember.
They read this. The Jews read this. Still, that's their go-to book. One of the two named after a woman. Okay, what else? That's a good way to get started, just to kind of looking at the whole thing and how multi-layered it is. Barry.
As I was reading through this, I always look at the story from more from Ruth's perspective, but this time it was like more like Naomi. And kind of like the whole mentor conversation we had about a year ago. Mm-hmm. It's like how awesome of a mentor like Naomi was for Ruth, and how much trust does Ruth put in Naomi to kind of guide her through the process. And there was something special about Naomi that was attractive, you know. And she was she had a respect for God and faith in God that was apparently contagious. Mm-hmm. And Ruth saw something in that and just used Naomi as her mentor.
Yeah,
to kind of guide her through these life events and getting used to the Jewish culture and customs with her back.
good.
She's a pretty good mentor.
An older woman teaching a younger woman. Yeah. That's what the New Testament tells us to do. Yeah, good point. Mentoring is so important. And we see this, a woman doing it here to a younger lady. And a lot of things not said that we can actually assume. We have to assume that, you know, all these things that she was able to bring her through and teach her so that she could assimilate in, back into the to the Jewish society. Okay, what else? Lisa?
I liked how strong Ruth was, and I also liked that the basic needs of she still needed shelter and warmth and comfort and a redeemer, and we need that today. And the sheltering part was big for me because that's just so basic. Everyone needs shelter, and it hasn't changed since from then today.
We seek that, right? Mm. Yeah, and she was a strong woman. She was very determined, wasn't she? Determined. What else we got? Brian?
Two things struck me this time. I hadn't remembered as much about Boaz and him looking out for them so much, or looking out for her character or well-being, and kind of the decisions he made and some of the thinking behind it. There was a lot, it seemed like, that went into it. He had it thought out and hadn't recalled that. And the second was just the whole idea of family in the book and how close they were and all those laws we've talked about and what they meant. But how important that was for them to get this piece of land back into the right name, and you know, that all the things that went into it, how close they were around the family piece, and the genealogies in here as well, that's part of the family. It's unusual. Today we don't, I don't think families are that close, especially big families. They get spread around and they're not, you know, different branches wouldn't be that close. Your immediate family, of course, but like your grandfather's brother, his family, they all seem to be very tight.
Yeah.
Back here, we don't have that level.
Yeah, and that came up Sunday. I thought it was a very interesting discussion about the family, about how close-knit and how we take care of people. I think Jeff brought up some things about how we maybe aren't as close-knit. In my lifetime, this has changed in my lifetime. I mean, some of your lifetimes as well then, right? Because you're at least close to my age or beyond. I mean, I remember we had a very... I remember going to my grandmother's house, and everything kind of swirled around there, and everybody kind of lived fairly close together, and they would, you know, you'd hear the cars come down with the gravel, and they always know, who's that? You know, somebody, and coming down the gravel driveway. And that was kind of the experience of me when I was growing up. It was always family members, you know, cousins and aunts and uncles and all that, and they're always around. Sometimes we had a big table that we ate a 2 o'clock meal. I remember eating a 2 o'clock meal when I stayed there, a big supper, I guess they call that, supper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all family there. And just kind of took that for granted. My cousins lived in the back of where my grandparents lived in Patterson. And it was kind of special. And I only spent a couple of weeks of the year there each year, but it really had got that feeling for what we're seeing here. And that has changed. We become more distant, and there are a lot of reasons for that. Not all necessarily bad, but that's just the way it is. And so that's kind of neat. You kind of have a throwback here to those times. Rich?
So I see that there was a lot of kindness towards Ruth, who was not only a foreigner, but not an Israelite, not a Jew.
Right.
And that runs a little counter to some things that we've studied and read before, how the Jews treated non-Jews. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see any of that.
Well, that's good, yeah. That's right. And that's a real important theme here, isn't it? That's why we did bring out, I know one of the questions, at least on one of the lesson sheets, was why the narrator keep calling her Ruth the Moabite? You know, why keep bringing that up? You know, once she's come, she's already converted, theoretically. You know, we know that she kind of converted to the religion. She's loyal to Naomi, and why even bring that up anymore? And but they do, and I think that's exactly the reason. It's to accentuate. Remember, when was this book written?
During the period of the Judges.
Period of Judges. It takes place during the period of the Judges. So this becomes like this little tiny headlight in a very, very dark world. And so the themes here are meant, I think, to raise those kinds of issues. Here's a Moabite, but if you put her out in the Judges world, in the world of the book of Judges, she's probably in trouble. Right? You bring her into the book of Ruth with Naomi in this little town, you know, that, and she's accepted. And there's a huge gospel, that's a huge gospel precursor, isn't it? What is the gospel? The gospel, everybody, right? We talked about this on Tuesday morning. So, in terms of Ephesians, because Ephesians is talking about breaking that down that wall of partition, and that everybody's equal, and all of these things, and we had a big discussion about that, and that's a major theme here.
I got the idea that there's a little enclave of Jews here who are trying to practice the law. You know, like you say, mm-hmm. it's a shining light in the period of the Judges. And I also am aware that, you know, Bethlehem is very close to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was not Jewish. It was still been the Jebusites. Mm-hmm. David took it away from the Jebusites later. You know, so they were a suburb to a big Canaanite city, mm-hmm. you know. But they were a little enclave of, seemed like faithful people trying to be faithful Jewish people.
Yeah, it's good. A little church, right?
Yeah.
A little church of people, you know, that are trying to do the right thing, trying to follow God, and you just kind of see that throughout the word. What Hebrew word is used? You brought up the English word, but Hebrew word is used here. That is kind of a huge word in the Old Testament, that meaning kindness.
Hesed.
Yes, I do think you know that. We're all Hebrew scholars now because we know that word. Technically, I have the C in front of it, but in the Hebrew, but chesed is probably something like that. But it means typically translated loving kindness. And you just see this kindness here on the part of everybody, pretty much. A little bit of a wondering, well, what did the women think when Naomi came back and, you know, she's feeling better and all this stuff. You kind of wonder what may be going on. And one thing I love about this book is what I mentioned earlier, is that there's a lot of that kind of thing. Okay, what were they thinking right then? You know, why did they do this? And I think that's what we do when we read a story, isn't it? We kind of try to get inside the head a little bit of the people that are there and put ourselves in there. That's kind of the idea. So, there's a lot of that, and this is a little shining light. It happens to be Bethlehem, which is a pretty important little place, you know. Not in the big scheme of things, not in the big world history yet thing, other than the fact that we, you know, everything surrounding Jesus eventually, but it's kind of cool. What else you got? Gary?
Two things, two aspects that have helped me. Is the first is Ruth's resolve. Mm-hmm. A popular verse where, you know, she told Naomi when she was determined to go, but, you know, your people will be my people. Where you go, I will go, and your God will be my God. Just that resolve that she had, and where Naomi was down, it said that she was bitter. Call me bitter, but Ruth kept a good attitude. She acted like she had a good attitude. She went out in the field and gleaned, and mm-hmm. so she was. She has that resolve that she's going to go where God's people are, and she's going to do it. And the other thing that is just kind of, I only scoop out 6 scoops of oatmeal now because I don't go to get to my rest until I go to heaven. And I need Ruth's resolve to get there. And it was Boaz. He gave her, there's 6 scoops in her garments there to take back to Naomi because he's not going to rest. God rested on the 7th day. So she didn't get 7 scoops, she got 6. And when I get to heaven, then I get the 7th one.
Yeah,
and until I get
good
to
sermon
office,
right there. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
It keeps me going.
Well, let's just talk a minute, just kind of focus this for a minute, and you can kind of go wherever you want. But since been brought up a couple times. But what about Ruth? We know, what's the most famous aspect, what's the most famous characteristic about her, at least most talked about? You mentioned, Terry just mentioned it, right? You mentioned resolve or her loyalty, right? Her loyalty. Verse 16 and 17, of course, is the verse that's quoted. If you Google Ruth, the book of Ruth, you're going to get that one. That's going to come up on your little, you know, fancy little graphics. It's going to come with this little statement of loyalty. As you know, we've talked about it, used at weddings. The wife says that to the husband, you know, which it wasn't, that's out of context, but the words are so perfect that it fits that kind of loyalty theme. And isn't there a lesson just to be learned from that? All by itself, if that's all you ever saw in here, what is this thing called loyalty, and how does it compare maybe to where we are today in a lot of respects in our culture? How important is loyalty? Right.
Could we define it as trust? I mean, she was going someplace that she'd never been, and you know, I think there's trust in that, and just like we trust in things that sometimes we don't understand, but we trust in them because God said them, you know.
Right.
And I think that's the type of loyalty she had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think she was timid by any means. She didn't demonstrate that when she got there.
No.
But I think that she, you know, she kind of stuck her neck out because it was something she was not familiar with. But she just said, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to go with you and I'm going to trust you.
Yeah, this goes back a couple of things there then, right? I mean, it goes back to she had courage, and she was taking a risk, wasn't she? Now, going back to what Barrett was talking about the mentoring that Naomi did, apparently, while she was in, they were in Moab, and how much she had built that trust. She had built the trust Ruth had built trust in her. She had the trust in Naomi, so she was willing to follow her. And it's at least a symbolic of the trust we ought to have for God, right? In God and Christ, and it's symbolic of that. But this is very real. This is putting your trust in another person who's going to lead you, much like Abraham. You know, I'm going to go to a land. I know nothing about this land. I'm going to follow this person. In Abraham's case, he followed, do what God said. So. That's what she did, and when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. She says it was that strong, that determined. It's just like a kid, you know, that won't give up, won't let go. They just keep being they're persistent, you know, just want to keep pushing. If I okay, yeah, you know, they know that too. They know how to work you, right? So, but this is something she. She just wanted to stay with her. And it's kind of odd because you'd think she'd been much more comfortable back in Moab where she'd been living. And so it's remarkable, actually. So loyalty certainly is that. Where do we need loyalty in our world today? Or where do you see it lacking, maybe? Let's talk about loyalty for a minute.
What? Lacking everywhere, I mean, in relationships, whether it's marriage, but even in, I don't know, co-workers or any kind of relationship.
Kind of weak, huh? I mean, and I think this isn't necessarily a bad thing on its face, but we do, these days, people change jobs a lot quicker and a lot faster than they used to in the old days. I mean, the average person, I think, coming out of college has 7 or 8 jobs and kind of settles down. And you know, I'm sitting with my grandfather. We talk about that table. I'm sitting around. He's working at this camera for 45 years. Ends up with a gold watch. You know, probably not real gold, but that was the deal. And that was just the way people were. They just kind of stuck with it. They stayed in the same place. You know, they were loyal to their family, loyal to their jobs, loyal to everything. And it was just kind of a. I'm not trying to say it was a good old days and all that kind of stuff. I'm just saying that was a feature. That I think I saw. You have duty and loyalty. If you're in the military, you're loyal to that. I saw my dad's generation, and when I was in the Army, I saw a failure of that in a lot of places, where a lot of guys during the Vietnam era were different in that respect than what I had learned about military people and things like that. So, and then what's loyalty? to the church now. You say all these things, you're going to, the loyalty to God through and to each other. Are we to be loyal to each other? Is that a word that fits?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we are, right? We're loyal. I'm loyal to you, you're loyal to me. And maybe the Three Musketeers, only there's more of us. Okay. So, yes?
I have another. As a mother-in-law, it's important to teach virtue, and as the young ladies who will be mother-in-laws, just know that that's a real special relationship, and to tread lightly and don't do anything wrong, and just work really hard to get close to each other, and you know, keep your mouth shut. Because you don't have like two chances, you know. You have one daughter-in-law, and don't mess it up and work really hard
one
to
more.
Yeah. You know, just teach, and you'll realize that sometime they'll come back to you and they'll ask you, "Oh, Mama Lisa, what do you think of this?" You know, and when you think they're not listening. So just tread lightly and teach.
Right. That's interesting, because if you watched TV talk shows in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 100s, what was one of the main jokes? So it was a
mother-in-law
jokes. I mean, you hear the mother-in-law jokes all the time. Well, this is actually a story about a mother-in-law, isn't it? This is basically the perspective is the mother-in-law, who's anything but the object of scorn. So that's a good point. I mean, there's a direct connection there, and goes back to that idea that mother-in-law can be a mentor and a friend and someone that you can be loyal to, and that's the best possible scenario, right? It's the best. It's what you hope for. And I have a great mother-in-law. I love my mother-in-law, and always have, and I'm fortunate that way.
And you can't speak to your daughter-in-law how you could speak to your son. And don't think you can.
No. I think I know what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, they can speak to the son-in-law different mm-hmm. than the daughter. Okay, that's another story. Yes, sir.
Speaking of loyalty and commitment, we tend to, it seems like in our culture in this day and age, I guess we are disloyal because we're looking out for number one.
Yeah.
We're looking out for fleshly desires, things that we want, versus the commitments that we've made. I like to think that Boaz loved Ruth when she came to the threshing floor, but despite whatever feelings he had for her, he was ultimately loyal to the law and to the custom. He was willing to risk another man buying all that she had and losing her. And that was more important to him than his loyalty and his commitment to the customs and the law of the time, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I do. I think he did. I think I agree with you. I mean, we were kind of reading a little bit into this, but it seems that he had had his eye on Ruth, and then he did have to, he wanted to do the right thing, so he did go through the process and offer her to the near kinsman, and he may have used a little bit of strategy in the way he handled all that. I don't. We had that discussion on Sunday. I think about. He said, "I can be." Oh yeah, you get Ruth too. You know, she's remember the Moabite lady. You know, but not sure about all that. But the that's true. That's a good point. He was committed to God, committed to the law, and then he was obviously committed to Ruth.
One thing I noticed is. This could be a book on character qualities. At first, I always thought of it as a love story, but then you started reading, like, oh, this could be a great lesson for kids on look at all the character qualities that each character had, being honorable, loyalty, kindness, respectful, all those things, qualities that we want to teach our kids. And they can be a lot of character qualities from all these characters.
Absolutely.
And then I kind of forgot about how God's plan and bringing Christ into it. It's kind of amazing how it all was designed.
Yeah. Yeah, it came down to basically these people.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously God would have worked this out, but I think we all agree that, because Ben will say something like, I'm going to open a can here. The can is the can of worms, you know. He's talking about, I'm going to open this can, you know. We get into the providence discussion. But I do think we would probably all agree that these people had free choice, that they had the right to make these decisions or not. And I think God let them do that. If they had not made the decisions they did, this story probably wouldn't be in the Bible. This would not have been written. It would be somebody else's story or something else. But the fact is, the way it happened, the decisions that were made came down to one person, basically. Everything, all these things happening to bring what we have at the very end, the genealogy of Jesus. So that's interesting, you know, and how God uses people. He takes them as they are. They can make these choices. He takes people of character who then make these proper choices as they go along. Or in Ruth's case, she made, I think, obviously the proper choice. One of my first questions in this was why did Naomi kind of urge Orpah to go, you know, when she knew she's sending her back to the pagan land? You know, I thought, you might think, well, she'd urge both of them to come with her, and maybe she's testing her, who knows? But the fact is, Ruth did go with her, and she probably learned enough about a relationship with God that she wanted that. And she came, but he uses all these people with their fine character, and it all results in this beautiful story, you know, that we're reading about and enjoy reading about. It's really we're going to get into, when you get into Esther, you're going to read about it. One person says that the first foiling of the Nazis, Esther. You're going to read about Haman, who's a, you know, just a really wicked person. And then even the marginally good people in there aren't that great, other than Esther and Mordecai. But so you see some bad actors. And here you don't get that part of it. You don't. It kind of rises out of a bad period of time and shines with... and I think you're right. I think you read all your kids, you know, and just say, look at the character here. Look at each one of these people and how they acted and how they... dealt with things, and it's a little character study. Definitely. What else?
You mentioned it, but it is a book of decisions. I mean, almost every character makes an important decision. Even minor characters like Orpah or the unnamed closer kinsman are only in there for a couple of verses, but in that period they make a decision that's pretty key to the story. So
it's really fascinating when we think about where we are today, right? We're sitting. What are we here? This. What is this? The Church of Christ, Church of Jesus, Church of Christ. When you look at this story, guess what? Because of what happened here, we're here. I mean, this was pivotal to us doing what we've been doing and have our relationship with Christ. You're going to see that with Esther too, because if Esther hadn't done what she did, if she hadn't made the decision she did, all the Jews would have been wiped out. That's why they call it the first Nazi foil. he was to exterminate all the Jews, get rid of them, and that would end it, because salvation is from the Jews. That's what Jesus says in John 4:20. It comes through the Jewish line that had to be preserved in order to give us Jesus, who was born right here in Bethlehem. So, it's just fascinating when you look at it from that. We've got this historical hindsight now of all these years it just makes this kind of remarkable to see how God worked through these people.
Yeah, but God wasn't going to let that happen.
No, I know. And that's what I said. He would use it. You'll see this in Esther, where Mordecai says, well, deliverance will come from other somebody. But who knows? Maybe you've been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this. You know, that's kind of going to be kind of our central verse that we'll look at in Esther, because Yeah, God would have brought it through, no question. But we'd still be here, I think, in some form. But it's interesting to go back and read about how here's one avenue through which that was done. And it required a really hard decision on Ruth's part, I would think. It required some tragedy, right? Didn't all this come out? Did we ever forget the first part of this? This came from adversity, really terrible adversity. You have a husband who takes his family to a foreign country that has been an enemy of Israel, and lives there, sojourns there, then stays there probably longer than they planned to, and then all the guys die. The husband dies, not the husband, the kids, the boys, the two boys die. And in this culture, in this day, it's not like today where we can kind of get along if that happens, but in this day, that was their lifeline. That was their lifeline. Naomi's lifeline was gone. And so she decides to go back, and Ruth kind of tags along with her. Well, that doesn't necessarily make her job any easier, does it? Now, because you could be thinking, well, now I've got to be taking care of my daughter-in-law, and I can't take care of myself. So you can kind of see how this all rises out of the ashes to movie plot. You know, it comes out of out of the ashes comes this tremendous blessing for everybody. Everybody wins in the end. It's you watch a movie, go to a movie, and then everybody claps at you. Because if you really dramatize all this and bring it all out, you know, you kind of get weepy and all those good things that now that I'm older, I get that way a little bit. I never would have done that when I was younger, but so it's really it's really a great story to me at that point.
True that.
Is it weepy? I've always been weepy.
Yeah. Have you?
No.
Yeah, you finally decide it's okay to be weepy. You get a little, you're not proud as a guy, you know. Yes, Sam.
Oh, no, I just had another comment.
Go ahead.
So, one minor thing that comes out a couple times that is, I thought it was just a good reminder, is people are always watching, right? Ruth made the decisions she did because of her character and because she was genuine. But because of that, because of her character and her genuineness, and she was able to have a positive interaction with Boaz. If she would not have been a worthy woman and had not have made the right choices, she wasn't making those choices because Boaz was watching, but he was, through his network and through others. So
yeah.
It's important that we, for her, it had very physical, benefits because she made good decisions, but it allowed her to have a positive conversation. And just the, for us today, making sure that people are always watching, and it's gonna affect how we're gonna be able to communicate with others and be effective in spreading the gospel.
Yeah, very good. Make every occasion a great occasion, because you never know who might be watching you. Make every occasion a great occasion. I was taught that when I was in management at one point. And I thought it was always something that I thought about in terms of my mother and my mother-in-law and my wife, and how they kind of, when they're going to do something, they try to do it right and well. And you make, but in the management context, they say make every occasion a great occasion because somebody may be watching you. That was the exact thing. And so you kind of see that character in Ruth, where that's just who she was, and she worked hard, and she was just that kind of person. And so it's not that you have to do that and manipulate that. It's who she was. But I loved her work ethic. I mean, that's something that struck me. The very first thing that we see when she goes out and gleans, and she just works all day, and the foreman notices it, and Bragg says, "Wow, she's been there all this time." And she just goes to town, and she's not some, little frail thing that goes out there and take care of me. She goes out there and does work that I wouldn't want to do. I picked strawberries. I think I mentioned that one time for a summer. I hated that job, and you can just see her just going out there and just doing it, not whining about it, or as far as we know, I don't think she did or anything, just working. I really appreciate, I think it's the way I was raised with my dad and stuff, but I really appreciate people who have a strong work ethic. I just really, and I, you know, and that's, obviously they can slip into workaholism and all that stuff, but that's, I'm just people that are willing to work hard at what they do. I admire people who do that. I know my wife does too. But it's, I hope you all do. I mean, I hope it's all something, a quality that we all admire. I mentioned the empty full theme here. Do you know what I was talking about with that? Remember that?
Yes.
Does that kind of resonate with you a little bit, this idea that they went out empty, came back full? And, you know, you kind of see that working in here, and I think it's kind of, what, how does that connect up with the gospel? I think there's a gospel connection there when you think about this going away empty, or coming back empty in this case. They come back, they were empty, they go, they get full, I guess, in Moab, and they come back empty-handed, right? Come back empty-handed. Here I am, but empty-handed. Nothing, how'd that go?
Came back bitter and ended up sweet.
They came, yeah. They're, repeat that for people.
Came back bitter and ended up sweet.
Yeah, she came back bitter and ended up sweet, right. So it's a theme that isn't that kind of basic to the gospel. What's the first beatitude in Matthew 5:3? What's the first one? Blessed are the
poor in spirit.
You know what that means? Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the empty-handed. Blessed are those who have nothing. Blessed are those who are in abject poverty. And it's in spirit. It means that that's the way you make yourself. You come empty. And then that's the only way we can come to God is empty. We have nothing to offer Him. And so that theme, I think, is very important in Ruth, because that's how she comes. She comes to Boaz. When she comes to Boaz, she has nothing to offer him, as far as from her perspective. It's strictly him in operating on her behalf. And she's dependent on that, or becomes dependent on that. So, the near Redeemer wasn't going to take her, so. And as a Moabite, that's why it keeps repeating this. She had nothing, she had even less than nothing to give. She is at zero. She had zero status. And that's a theme that we see, I think, throughout the Bible. That's why Jesus talks about us becoming as little children. Unless you're converted, become as little children, and I'll see the kingdom of God. What did go over children's rights in New Testament times? They had none. They didn't have rights. Parents loved them, just like we love our kids, but they had no status, no rights. So, okay, we've got 5 minutes. What else we got? Yes?
Just kind of the children theme. If I understand verses 14 and 15 right, it looks like the women come to Naomi and say, Obed is your Redeemer.
You're looking at which word?
Chapter 4,
verses
14 and 15.
Yeah.
It looks like the women come and say to Naomi, Obed is your Redeemer, not Boaz. And he's giving you back. He's restoring your life. He's nourishing you in your old age. So, you know, your grandchild, you know, he's bringing you back from this place, this bad place where you were when you first arrived.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it kind of assumes, you know, it does kind of assume, you have the Redeemer, and Boaz comes to, well, that baby, that doesn't necessarily, could be a girl, right? Could have like 6 girls, right? We have some of those. We got birds or some David, and you know, you have all these girls everywhere and just keep coming with girls. But it did kind of depend on that ultimately. That he becomes the object of redemption. And he's the one that's in the line, right? I mean, he's the one that's in the line. Yeah, good point. So it comes down to a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need a boy named Obed.
You have a boy named Obed. And that's really the only place in this, in this story where God is actually said to have a part. You kind of speculate on the other stuff. It's about God did this, God did that, but it's the only place where it says the Lord has, verse 14, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. So that seems to indicate he was obviously manipulating all this part, all the rest. We don't know, but yeah, good point. So Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David, and the rest is history. And we find, when you go, where else do you find Ruth mentioned? Matthew chapter 1, in the genealogy of Jesus, along with what other women? Tamar.
Bathsheba,
not by name, but Bathsheba, yes.
Rahab.
And then of course Mary. All of the, what do all those women have in common?
Had some sort of taint.
Some taint, some little chink in their armor, right? In every case. Even Mary, who's pregnant without the benefit of marriage, as far as everybody can see. So that's interesting. How common was it for Jewish genealogies to have women in them? It wasn't. They didn't do that. They didn't put women in there. Especially Moabite women and what have you. So there are little hints like that in the, as we look through the Bible, that we say, well, God really was, he really did exalt women in many ways and in many places throughout Scripture. And they become, in our case, become, in these two cases, just taking, saying God left everything to humans, which he would have used another avenue, but say he left everything to humans. Ruth and Esther are two women who are responsible for us being here today as Christians. We're here because of what they did, and then the decisions that they made, the way it worked out. That's the way it worked out. I don't believe that God was controlling every single action, and that it kind of takes the whole magic out of it for me, if that's true. They had to make these decisions that then resulted in where we are today. So that's kind of cool. Yep. I think we're done. So, read Ruth to your kids. and enjoy it. But we're not going to read through Esther on Sunday. It's a long book, much longer than this. So please, at least read the first four or five chapters of that, or read the whole thing. It won't take you that long. That'd be a good thing to do. Thank you.
Straighten this out. Thank you.
I was joking.
Oh, okay.